I'm Bale, and this is the LSQ Podcast.
I can't believe I've known Chris Bayo for 15 years. Crazy. And the fact that it took us this long to have this conversation, well, I'm just glad we finally got to. I learned so many fun facts about young Bayo, and we got to talk about one of our favorite topics, Sex and the City. How are the Sex and the City ladies like the Beatles? Well, we'll discuss that and more in LSQ episode 57. Hi, I'm Jenny LSQ. Thanks for pressing play. It's a strange and interesting day historically because we're connecting on Inauguration Day, January 20th, 2021. And I'm just going to go ahead and say I feel huge relief. We made it. And, you know, there's something a little different in the air today, I think.
It was, yeah, I mean, I got up and watched, you know, like about an hour of the inauguration. And I did feel it a bit in the immediate aftermath of the election, like this kind of like weight that had been there, that, you know, the kind of like instability, the fact that a maniac was head of the government, that had been, you know, at the very best of times, a kind of like low simmering anxiety that went away for a couple days after the election. But then it kind of came back as stuff was getting crazy. And I kind of underestimated how relieved I would feel when the like power had been switched, when, you know, someone new came into the office of the presidency. So I, Jenny, am in a good fucking mood today as we talk together.
Awesome. I want to, right from jump, talk about something, not the kind of thing I usually talk about on this podcast, but we have some common interests outside of music. And so I do have to ask how you feel about no Samantha for the Sex and the City reunion. Any thoughts or feelings on that?
You know, I meant to look this up. First off, it's just great. Like, I've been doing interviews pretty regularly since the year turned over. So this is like my third week of having a pretty packed interview schedule. But this is the very first question I've gotten about Sex and the City, which is arguably one of the most important topics that I could discuss with anybody. So I appreciate that. And as you've alluded to, we are part of a since dormant Sex and the City trivia team. But I had listened to this super kind of like long form podcast in like the end of 2018. I never do this during interviews, but it's such a good podcast that I'm going to have to look it up on my phone while I talk to you.
Yes, please. Yeah, please do. I want to give a recommendation to the people.
This is like the best, and it's like 5 hours. Okay. It's like 5 hours on the history of Sex and the City, and the podcast is called Origins, and like they do a different seasons on a different TV show. The first season was on Curb Your Enthusiasm, which I thought that season was okay, but the Sex and the City season is just like absolute masterclass, one of the best podcasts I've ever listened to. And just like, you get to sort of like peer behind the curtain of this incredibly iconic show. I'm a big fan of Sex and the City. It got me through kind of like a dark time when I was 18, just because my parents had the DVDs in our basement. So I just like spent like weeks plowing through Sex and the City episodes. And I love the show. But so this podcast, it really gave just like a long, particularly in the last episode, kind of like a long breakdown of how they tried to make a Sex and the City 3 movie, and that, you know, negotiations kind of fell apart, and that Kim Cattrall did not want to be a part of it. And you know, I think it can be tough to think about the fact that business is intertwined with art. Every, like, public artist, every public-facing artist, there is, like, a business side to it. And sometimes when you, like, really think about it or wrap your head around it, it's like a bit unseemly. You just think, like, Sex and the City, it's just, you know, fucking great writing, great acting, everybody's just showing up, everybody's getting along, there's like no simmering tension. And I will say, in Kim Cattrall's defense, and Jenny, we have actually watched side by side the first two Sex and the City movies, and did the world need a follow-up after Sex and the City 2? I think that we would, as two big fans, would say absolutely not.
Please no.
Apparently, the script for Sex and the City 3 was like great Michael Patrick King, who was the showrunner starting with the third season, he was like, oh, this is just like a beautiful script. Sarah Jessica Parker loved the script. But there were all these negotiations, and Kim Cattrall didn't want to be a part of it. And so it fell apart. And like, everybody's diplomatic, but they kind of talk around the fact that Kim Cattrall, like, essentially wanted a lot more money, and there was this, just like this kind of like falling out between everybody. So like, listening to this podcast and when I talk about it being like unseemly, it was kind of like hearing about like this couple that you love, this like couple that you hang out with all the time. Maybe they were together for 10 years. You'd go to dinner together. You'd see each other at parties, and then they break up, and you get like, but like having like an inside window into what happened and why that relationship broke up. So it's depressing. It's sad. You know, they're like, it's like the Beatles, you know, it's like
by Let It Be, you know,
it's the Beatles of, you know, 90s and 2000s, HBO yeah. TV shows. And so the fact that Kim Cattrall didn't want to be a part of it and that everybody else wanted to push along, I'm going to give it a chance.
You know, the experience of doing the Sex and the City trivia team, and also just as I've gotten to know you better and see the way your fanhoods kind of play out, whether, you know what I mean? Whether it's the burnt thing, for instance, or any number of other deeply personal memes for you specifically. When did that kind of thing start for you? What was the first thing like that, that as a human you became fixated on in a way that made so much sense to you?
Oh, God. I think when you, like, share this weird piece of cultural ephemera with someone else, it becomes this kind of like secret language. And so the example that you bring up is the movie Burnt, which I saw under very like kind of weird circumstances and thought the movie was fucking insane. And then just like found myself on an email chain with two friends. We were talking about something else, and a friend brought up that he had watched Burnt on a plane. And then we just started emailing each other about Burnt, and we couldn't stop talking about that movie because it's an insane movie. And like, then it kind of just became this joke. And then I have like a WhatsApp group with like eight other people where we just still talk about Burnt. There was like, I got messages on my phone maybe 20 minutes before I got on with you about the 2015 failed Bradley Cooper Bad Boy Chef feature Burnt. And like, it is, and I'll put like Instagram stories up about it and like tweets, and like, it's just nobody knows what the fuck I'm talking about. Very few people I think have seen Burnt, but like it ends up taking up this like big place in my mind. And I don't know, just there'll be like examples when I think back and I can't even really remember the jokes, but like just like watching a bad movie at like a friend's house and like picking out lines and like just making like jokes about it. I'm trying to remember anything like super, super specific.
I guess I also just mean more generally, like the kind of joy that you get out of, like, you know, just digging into something. I mean, it's being a nerd. It's ultimately where you're just hyper into something to a point that for other people might be uncomfortable. But you're like,
that's
how into it I am. I don't care. As a kid, what was the first thing that you made you feel like, I just need more of this? This is so exciting to me.
Yeah, and I guess, okay, I think about like my friends who have kids and stuff like that. And almost like uniformly, when their kids are like 2 or 3 years old, they'll tell me that their child is like obsessed with this one movie and just like want to watch the same movie every single day. And I think there's something kind of like naturally childlike about getting obsessive about something. I think it's like kind of like innate to being human when I think about it in terms of like seeing it through, you know, all my friends' kids. So I think that there can be like a childlike joy to preserving that, you know. Now I'm 36 years old, but like still being obsessive about some random obscure thing. So, you know, things like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles when I was a kid, or like, I mean, I was obsessed with Bohemian Rhapsody when I was 7 years old, just wanted to listen to Bohemian Rhapsody on loop. I mean, even now, if I like really get into a song, I can listen to the same song for like 3 or 4 hours. And I think that like there just is this sort of like, yeah, just childlike joy in in getting obsessed with one thing or, like, you know, one like work of art.
So going back to Bohemian Rhapsody for a minute, then, as a little dude being obsessed with that song, there's obviously cartoonish elements to it in addition to the musicality. But did that develop into your early music taste?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it would have just been like trickle down stuff from my parents. My dad, like, I know a lot of people when they have kids, they got, like, my one of my uncles, unbelievable record collection, and like it stops, you know, he let me take a bunch of records from it. I've got, like, you know, early pressings of Can records, just like an absolutely, like, impeccable record collection. He went to law school in like 1982. There's like, it just stops right there, and then like he had kids after that. Just like they're like, for a lot of people, you know, you hit a certain age and you just like are not actively following new music. But my dad was very much not that way, and he like would always, you know, he's a true stone cold Columbia househead. Just like, and also would read Spin obsessively, and like I even have memories because I didn't like curse words when I was really young, and so my dad would like read Spin and like get a black ink and just blot out the curse words for me. It was like just like insane to think about, but like
so
really
nice.
Really sweet. But so he would always bring home records, bring home things that he was interested in, and it like always ran a wide gamut. But like Bohemian Rhapsody would be the first thing that I can just remember, like just being in the car and just being like, I love this song, I just want to hear this song over and over and over again. And like, you know, there would be Talking Heads, there'd be plenty of other, like, I mean, my dad's favorite musician is Jimi Hendrix. We would listen to so much Jimi Hendrix. But at the same time, he would like, you know, I'd be 10 years old when he would have bought his first Guided by Voices record, and we would have had that on in the house, and just like kind of like always having music around in the house, like reading the Saturday or Sunday paper. That was kind of just how I grew up. So there wasn't like one sort of like defined sensibility. You know, my dad would buy like Tribe Called Quest, my dad would buy Green Day, just like whatever were like kind of like big albums at that time. And so I just, you know, would listen to a fairly wide like gamut for like a 7, 8, 9, 10 year old. And like how it trickles down later when I started playing music is kind of hard to say, but it was it definitely is like a huge reason why I'm a musician today.
When did you start to see music as something that you might do and be interested in playing it, as opposed to just enjoying it always being around?
I started getting piano lessons when I would have been like 9 or 10 years old, and I didn't actively really want to, but my mom like kind of made me and signed me up, and thank you, Mom, you changed my life. But I really took to it. I really liked playing, and kind of at the end of the first year, my teacher at the time told my mom that he thought I could like maybe someday be a professional musician. And like, I don't know, hearing that as a 10-year-old is kind of like all you need. If you're like super, super into playing music, and then your teacher thinks you like have what it takes to then play music, that's like, when I just think back and of like an early affirmation, that's the one in my head. Like hearing that at 10 years old, that like it was possible. And that definitely made me like take it even more serious and pursue it more, I guess.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, that's a good boost. And so did you start practicing more seriously? And when did the idea of writing songs on your own begin?
I played piano for another couple of years, and then I would have gotten a guitar for Christmas when I was 12, but I didn't really like pick it up in the first year and a half, for whatever reason. I don't even know why. I think I was probably just like more focused on piano at that time. But then once I picked it up, took lessons for maybe a year, I just like knew I wanted to play. So I would, you know, I would play in my friend Brian's attic. We would like cover Nirvana songs, you know, like fucking Come As You Are. I'm very curious to people who like pick up guitar now, how often like Come As You Are is that first song that you play. I wonder if it's still that. I mean, it was funny. I know that like Steve Lacy had told Ezra that A-Punk was the first song he learned on guitar, which just like blew my fucking mind in general. But like, I guess some people maybe listen, like learn A-Punk as their first song on guitar now, which is mind-blowing. For me, that version was definitely Come As You Are. So just playing with my friend Brian, and then like We had a band, started writing. We covered so many songs. And then I started writing songs like shortly thereafter. My first song was like a funk instrumental called Fat Boy Craving, which is just like it's like the kind of song you call like when you're like 13 years old. But I will say, and I'm just talking through this with you, and I still remember like what the guitar riff was to it. But on this record, the first song, like the back half, I would say has like a lot of funk guitar, and I hadn't really thought of it this way, but it's like my version maybe of like tapping into the first song that I wrote.
I mean, 13 is super young, but at what point did you start like going to shows or like identifying with, you know, music as being like, I love music, I'm that kid?
Yeah, way earlier, definitely. My family would go like every summer. I grew up in Westchester, New York. Every summer we'd go to like at least 5 shows at Jones Beach. That was like the kind of like family thing. And I saw so many, like a wide gamut. I would have seen everything from like Lenny Kravitz to Hootie and the Blowfish to Steely Dan to just like to the Cranberries, just like so many.
The Columbia House.
Columbia House in concert version, just like every summer at Jones Beach. And, you know, the very first concert I went to was when I was 9 years old. It was, it was a really killer triple bill. It was, the first band was Cracker, the second band was Gin Blossoms, and then the headliner was Spin Doctors. And
wow,
the first song that Cracker played, it's one off their second record, I think. That's kind of like, it's on the record with Get On This. Like, I've listened to that record like maybe a couple years ago. I'm gonna probably listen to it later today after it came up, but like, they opened with a song off that, and like just hearing a kick drum, like hearing a drummer's bass drum through a sound system and feeling it in your chest, it's just this immediate like physical thing. And it's a physical thing in a way that listening to any like recorded music on your house on like, you know, average house speakers, it can never achieve that. And so I just knew right away, I love going to concerts. I love this feeling. I love like the physicality of it. It was very nice, or something that was very fun for me. This came up in conversation maybe like 5 years ago, but this guy named Trey, who's sometimes the Strokes tour manager, he tour managed like Sleigh Bells, who are friends of mine, but he told me that he worked on that tour. I think maybe he was working in catering at that time. So it was very, very exciting to get a little bit of sort of like gossip of what was going on in the Spin Doctors on this tour, you know, like 25 years later or whatever.
Were they fighting like our Sex and the City ladies, or did they all?
Yes, yes. I think they're back to, I don't know, I haven't followed the Spin Doctors member situation, but it seemed like the situation was fraying with the guitar player, and the guitar player was mostly like just hanging out with the crew, and then the guitar player subsequently left the band after that tour. So it was kind of like it was very much like a Sex and the City like contract negotiations in 2016 or whatever.
What was the thing that you and your dad like both loved together the most of the music that somehow overlapped? Do you have a shared favorite with him?
Like
a concert that was a moment between the two of you?
Well, definitely like Nirvana. Just, we both were like, this shit is fucking incredible. We were both like very, very sad when Kurt died. I remember I played chess as a kid, and like driving home from a chess tournament, just listening to In Utero in the family car, just being like super sad. Those are kind of like ones that I share. I mean, yeah, there were so many shows that we went to and so many that we really liked. Yeah, I mean, I remember seeing Garbage at Roseland with him, and just like, when they were touring their second record, so I would have been a little older, like 12 or 13, but the show was just awesome, just like great, great show. And we like,
man,
both.
But I can't help but think about the Nirvana thing, because you would have been, how old were you? I mean, that must
I would have
been
like 11, maybe. Like
11, yeah, still 90... kind of, well, a hard, no, concept maybe... to understand a bit. Suicide.
No, I would have been 9. I would have been 9. Yeah.
Did you, do you remember no understanding, did you understand what had happened?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. And we, like, I watched, we had MTV on, like, just on loop. I just remember Kurt Loder, like, reporting on it and stuff like that. And I mean, it probably was. I mean, it was the first major, like, it contributed to my understanding of suicide. There's obviously absolutely no question of that.
I mean, I'm older than you, and I was working my part-time job at a real estate office. I was in college, and I had to go home from work. I was so upset that day.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
I was
yeah.
just like, I tried to continue, and then I was like, I gotta go. I can't do this. And what about just like more kind of indie leaning music scene? Did you, you know, as you got older and toward college, start like going to, you know, gigs at Mercury Lounge and that kind of stuff?
Yeah, definitely. I would go to like punk shows at Knitting Factory in high school. And I would, I played Knitting Factory once in high school, which was a like incredible, like fun, exciting achievement for me. Like it was like one of the highlights of high school. But yeah, I would go and I did college radio. So, you know, we would bring bands and book them. There would be so much. I mean, I loved the band Akron Family. I would go see them whenever they played in town. I saw them at Knitting Factory a bunch. WBAR was the radio station I did, and they would have played a show at the West End, which was kind of like a notorious, I don't think I'm being unkind in calling it a bro-y bar, like by Columbia, where I went to school, but, you know, we would put on shows at the basement, and like, just seeing, yeah, like, really, really good and interesting musical ideas expressed in like a sweaty basement with like 50 other people and just like incredible playing. And it was awesome. I was like getting to go to school in the city as a music obsessive. Yeah, it was like the dream.
What do you remember about when you first met the other Vampire Weekend guys? And how quickly did you move into talking about playing music together?
It was very like happenstance in the sense that My roommate my freshman year of college, Gabe Adoy, who's like one of my best friends on the planet, he had been an extra in a production of Romeo and Juliet at school, and two of the other extras were Ezra and Rostam. And so there was this dorm at Columbia called Ruggles that essentially, like, based on, I mean, it really is like so coincidental when I like break it down in my head that like it's put me on this path in life. But you know, certain dorms, you need, like, the way the rooms are laid out, there'll be like three doubles and two singles, right? And so you need to assemble a group of people where six people are okay with having a roommate, so that way the two people can have their single. So usually it ends up being like an upper class person, like up, and I don't mean that in the class system. I mean, yeah, someone who's a year above you or whatever. And then someone, you know, you need the six people to be younger. So Ezra had asked Gabe to kind of like assemble the like six people who would be the like lower classmen in this dorm. And so whatever, we just like, you end up like going to this certain place where the housing lottery is and you sign a paper. And that would have been like the first time I met Ezra, but like I thought he was cool. Like, and then kind of shortly thereafter, maybe like a week later, there was this thing called Collision at the end of the year at Columbia, where like all these like artists, people in the art program, would like hang their paintings. It would be like in a kind of like remote area of Brooklyn, and then like musicians would perform. And my friend, another friend of mine from college who's in my year, Eric Lindman, was like playing with Ezra and his band Loam Run, which you're familiar with, certainly, having known us now for whatever 14 years or however many years it's been. But that was Ezra's rap group that Rostam did a lot of production work for, and Chris Thompson played guitar in. And my friend Eric was playing. I think it was the only time he did it. Like he played some like electronic music on the side, like making like, you know, blips or whatever out of his keyboard. But I just got there and I saw their last song right when I walked in, and I was just like, this is so fucking fun. This is like such a like joyful approach to music. It's not like dour, self-serious. It's like people just like having a really good time playing music, and the music's really good. It's not like, it's just really good on top of everything else. And I just like, I don't know, I really like that. And so I started, you know, I was living with Ezra, and then I would just start going to their shows kind of like all the time when they played around campus, because I like really, really enjoyed. And, you know, Rostam would be there and I would just kind of get to know them. At the same time, like when I first got to college, I thought I would like play in a band and like continue writing music, and that didn't really happen in my first year. I didn't really meet anybody that I would play with. I didn't like feel super driven. By sophomore year, I just like brought my bass guitar to school. I was more a guitar player before that, but I just brought my bass because I was like, you know, maybe there'll be an opportunity. Everybody wants to play guitar. You're like a little bit more useful if you can play bass, because that's a slot that you need in a band. So I had a bass, and you know, Ezra would have heard me practicing down the hall, and I don't know, like a year later when he was putting the band together, he asked if I would play bass at Ding Dong Lounge on 107th Street in Columbus one night, and I said yes, and now I'm here.
You know, obviously I met you not that long after this story, and I remember just like you guys were so young when we met up for the first time at Mercury Lounge or at Library Bar.
Yes. Hell yeah. Oh yeah. That's I didn't remember where it exactly was. Exactly.
Yeah, and we did an interview for Rolling Stone in the back booth of Library Bar, and then you played a show at Mercury Lounge that was and then I just, you know, would come see you guys play all the fucking time. And it's interesting, you know, obviously, as you say, it's like you can look at these things and it's like, here we are now, you know, almost 15 years later, and everything that's happened has happened. But it sounds like when we look back at this together, yeah, you weren't really expecting any of this. I mean, obviously, you had spent your life and your childhood and teenage years like getting more proficient at playing all of the instruments, and like you really seriously loved music. But you were in a good school and you were probably thinking about a career in something, right? Or did you have any ideas at that point about a profession you might go into?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I will say, if you'd asked me at 16 if there was anything I could do with my life, it would be to play music. But by the time I got to college, I was like, all right, it's not really going to happen for me. That's fine. There's like plenty of other things. I was going to do 2 years with Teach for America. I had like accepted a job kind of before we got a record deal. I felt a little bit bad when I told them. It was early enough that I don't think I ended up depriving anyone of a spot of having a teacher in the program, but I ended up telling them I can't take it because I'm going on tour. I took the LSAT my senior year. I don't know if I ultimately would have wanted to be a lawyer or like liked being a lawyer, but it was something that I at least entertained. But no, it you're right when you say it kind of like it kind of just happened, and it really did. And I think that, like, in a way, the fact that it happened without me, like, being insanely, like, aggressive about it, or, like, just, like, a maniac, like, I have to pursue it, it's, like, kind of a good way to be. And I think about how we had this very first band practice, and there was this kind of vision of, like, having a horn section, adding a bunch of people, and, like, at the end of that first practice, I think Rostam was the one who said, you know, maybe it should just be the four of us. This feels really good. And, like, I agree. If it feels really good, it feels really natural. You're not pushing anything as, like, a baseline. That's, like, that's kind of, like, a great way to start in, like, work and in your life. So, I don't know. The fact that it felt good, felt right, has me, you know, I've never questioned since then being a musician. It's like, I'm not, yeah, it's funny to think about, I guess.
Do you think that adapting what you had been doing before that with songwriting and with playing music into, you know, when you were still young and impressionable as a musician and songwriter, like into the Vampire Weekend structure, like, did it change your approach to your own songwriting or to what kind of music feels good and right to play?
I would say that, you know, I came to college and then I didn't write a song for like 8 years, like a song. So maybe 9 years. I
guess I just mean sort of the larger kind of lessons of, you know, finding your own self as a musician within the context of Vampire Weekend.
Yeah, definitely. And I will say it was like immediately very different because I had been a songwriter in my band. I had been the one who like was kind of running the show, and having done that in high school and then playing in a band where I'm the bass player, I'm trying to like do the absolute best I can to help other people fulfill their vision. Like being on the other side of that, it gave me like more respect for both sides of that equation. And so, you know, just trying to write the best bass line I can, trying to serve the song to the best of my ability, was something very, very new for me. But I loved it. I do. And I think that, like, having a flexibility to work on music in different capacities, like, it goes toward, like, maybe it's related to that kind of openness and, like, easygoingness with, like, listening to a bunch of different genres of music from the time I was 7 years old. I don't know, but I've always loved playing in whatever form it takes. So learning how to best fulfill someone else's songwriting vision, it changed me completely. Absolutely.
I'm sure we talked about this when you put out the names back in 2015, and when you mention it, I'm reminded that, yeah, okay, I knew this, but it does, again, with time passing, it does seem interesting that was an experience, if I'm remembering correctly now as we talk about it, of starting again to write songs on your own, and also of kind of finding your singing voice and just figuring out what it should all sound like, and writing that batch of songs. And now, as we're talking on the cusp of the follow-up album to that, Dead Hand Control, you know, I can't help but wonder, yeah, did that really open a port? Like, you know, looking back now and thinking, how did you go 8 years without writing songs? It does seem to be something that is very satisfying for you.
Yeah, it just, I don't know. The reason, I guess, is that I was doing other things with that time, and I was not, like, driven to do it. And I think that to write a song, it should be, like, you have to do it. That should be the place, the starting point of any time you write a piece of music. And so, I don't know, I found that hunkering down, I had these songs all of a sudden. I didn't write, you know, I made, like, some electronic music. I wrote some music, but, like, in terms of writing a song with lyrics and singing, I didn't do it. And then all of a sudden, you, like, turn the faucet, and it's, like, all I wanted to do, you know, starting in maybe, like, 2013 for the most part. That was when I, like, started the real, like, main work, a little bit kind of like after Modern Vampires, of working on that first record. And the first three Vampire Weekend records were just, like, back to back to back, and we would go on these insane tours, like, and this is not a complaint, it was, like, awesome and really, really fun. But, you know, you'd be gone from home for 7.5 weeks, and then, like, when I'd come home, the first thing I'd want to do was not play music. You know, I just did that. It, like, had been such this dominating force in my life. And so when things were, like, kind of, like, slowing down, Modern Vampires, like, that was when I was like, okay, sitting at home, writing chords, writing lyrics, trying to sing, this is, like, fun for me. This is what I want to be doing.
And, I mean, how intuitively, like, the sort of figuring out what, okay, you were an established person and you had an established sound as the bass player in Vampire Weekend, like, how intuitively versus very deliberately did you figure out, okay, what does Bayo sound like? What does Bayo sound like at this point, 8 years into being in this well-known, familiar band?
I would say it was fairly starting from a place of deliberateness, and then along the way using a lot of intuition to get there. So you have, like, this idea, these overarching themes, you have certain sounds, and then that's, like, that initial kind of, like, burst of inspiration that ends up being the framework that you work in. And then you're kind of, like, coloring in the lines, or, like, solving the puzzle from there on, if I can use as many cliched metaphors.
What were on that first group of songs, what were the ones that kind of helped you figure it out? I mean,
I just, with that first record, I wanted something that, I mean, I love electronic music. I love DJing, and I had been doing it, like, kind of concurrently with Vampire Weekend, and I put out a couple EPs of electronic music. And at the time, I'm, you know, a huge fan of people like the Chemical Brothers, people like Fortet, people like Caribou. You know, they all put out records in 2010 that came out at a time where I was, like, learning how to produce, when I bought Logic, and I would just, like, figure out, try to, like, make sounds on my computer, and it took me a long time to not hate those sounds. But so I had been thinking a lot about how all these artists were, like, intertwining electronic music and songs over it. In the same like song, it would be these like kind of like unnatural sounds with a natural voice, whether it would be like, you know, chopped vocals in the case of like Fortet, or like, you know, features in the case of Chemical Brothers, or like, you know, singing over your own beats and stuff like Caribou. What I wanted to do with my record is I wanted to make a record, the first one, The Names, where it went as purely as possible into electronic music. I wanted there to be just a 7-minute techno song. There's not a single natural sound on it. And then I wanted to go as far possible as I could in like a pop or like, you know, rock direction, and have like a song that's all natural. It's all familiar sounds. It's guitar, bass, drums, vocals, piano. And I wanted them to live on the same record, and I wanted it to make sense. So that was kind of like the broadest idea that I had going into the record. I knew I wanted it to be instrumental for a long period of time, and then I love the idea of like a voice kind of emerging from nowhere. So that was the main idea. That was the starting point. That was the deliberateness. And then in terms of like filling in the blanks, writing all the songs, figuring out all the sounds, that's all the intuition. And that's, yeah, that was how that like the process of making that record was. And it was, you know, I played everything on that record, unlike this record. Yeah, I feel like I achieved what I set out to with that one, to like, you know, the best of my abilities at that time.
So for this new group of songs for Dead Hand Control, like, you know, as you've alluded to, that you didn't play all the instruments on this, you had, what were the ways in which you wanted to approach this differently? And obviously I know that you, although it's just coming out now, this was recorded before COVID and you had no idea.
Yeah, I wonder, like, when I'm posting footage of like Greta and Sasha singing, if people think I'm just flouting COVID protocols when the videos are from like summer of 2019. I hope not. I don't think anyone is. But yeah, with this record, I just wanted to take as much time as possible with it. I kind of knew I would be very busy with Father of the Bride stuff. So I had these ideas kind of starting around 2017 of what I wanted to make the record about. I had like read about the concept of Dead Hand Control, which is where in your will you try and control, you give your assets to a person, and after death you try and control what that person does with your assets. Like an example would be MCA of the Beastie Boys. When he passed away, in his will it said no Beastie Boys songs in commercials. That's one example, one famous example of Dead Hand Control. And it's very like difficult to enforce in courts and stuff like that. And then I was familiar with Dead Hand, which is this rumored Soviet nuclear system that if it detected a nuclear attack in the Soviet Union, it would nuke America in response. And it's like a computer. It's also called Perimeter. And apparently it still exists, so that's something that give you a little stress. But I was thinking about what I as an individual can control, what we all can control. I was thinking about the poetry of the turn of phrase Dead Hand Control, and kind of like reckoning with our own mortality and the limit of control. When I'm dead, I'm not actually going to be able to control anything. I'm going to be dead. And it's, in a way, a futile exercise, I think, to try and do otherwise. But so I was thinking about these concepts, and I would just like kind of gather ideas, come up with ideas for songs. A song title pops in my head, like Endless Me Endlessly, just like a turn of phrase that I like, it just popped into my head one day. It's like, okay, I like that turn of phrase. I want to make a song using that turn of phrase. And then I just, it's an exercise I do a lot when I make music, where it's like, I come up with a song title and then I imagine what that song would sound like. And I did that a lot on this record. Probably 5 of the 8 songs were that way. And I just, I don't know. I wrote it. In the middle of all this, I moved from London to Los Angeles in early 2018. I started building out a studio with my bandmate Chris Thompson. We took over Mario C, the Beastie Boys producer's space in Eagle Rock. We call our studio CNC Music Factory after the great 90s group. And just building the studio and like having a professional studio in a space where I could leave my house and go there and just be there all day. It was just different from how I've worked on solo music before. I took the music with me when I went to London, like on tour with Vampire Weekend. I work with an engineer, a guy by the name of John Foyle. I've worked with him on all my solo records where I sing. And he, like, we got to work in Damon Albarn's studio for 2 days because Damon was on tour with The Good, The Bad, and The Queen. And, you know, he's one of my favorite songwriters of all time. Speaking of Gorillaz, like one of the songs, I definitely am using the same synth as the track on Melancholy Hill, because like I just plug, you know, turn on Damon's synth and see the sounds and see what he had up. It was very, very fun for me as a huge fan of his. It was my favorite 2 days I've like ever spent recording music. And I just, yeah, I did it. Most of the recording was done around Vampire Weekend touring. So I would come home, like I came home from a European tour in July of 2019. And then I recorded my friend Robbie. He played drums all over the record. And I recorded Greta and Buzzy Lee, who both sing all the backups on the record. I don't know. I would have thought about it for a year, and then I would have worked on it for about 18 months. And the benefit of doing it around touring is that like I'd be home for a week. I'd say, I want to get this done while I'm home for this week, because I know I'm going to not be home after that. Then I would go off on tour. And while I was on tour, I could both think about what I had done in that week I was home and plan for like the next time I would be home for a week and what I would want to achieve. So it was the longest I've spent making a record, definitely.
Circling back to where we started with the subject of things that you're passionate about and deeply interested in, and also touching on the note of how you took your LSATs, and now there's an interlude of time when maybe there's no shows for a minute. I mean, do you ever think about some later phase of life where there's something that you would like to do, either for money or just for pleasure, but that's totally different from this? Like, when you look at, like, old Bayo, like, what are some things you could imagine yourself getting into that you haven't had the time or energy to do yet?
I do think that... I mean, I've enjoyed, I've been spending a lot of time in Oregon, so I've been enjoying, like, outdoorsy shit. I've been going on these incredible hikes. I was never, like, a big hiker, but I love hiking. I went kayaking for the first time in my life recently. I like that shit. I don't know if I'm going to keep pursuing this. I feel a little weird about it, but I took 2 golf lessons, which is not something I ever thought I would do, but... We'll see. It's a little weird, but I had fun. I liked hitting the ball. So, and I have a lot of friends who do it. If I were to like, I do think about having a different career, and like, I do actually think about going to law school. I think that, as I follow the news obsessively and, kind of like the legal side of everything that is happening in our country, I've found a lot of interest very specifically in the, Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice, which does very, very important work in this country in terms of like prosecuting hate crimes and things like that. And, you know, it's something that I've read about and I'm interested in. Will I end up getting a JD and going into some kind of public service or being some kind of defense attorney? I kind of doubt it, but it's something that I think about from time to time.
Yes, either that or you're going to go the Bill Murray route and become a semi-professional golfer. have you watched the Tiger Woods documentary?
I haven't. Now that I've taken my 2 golf lessons, I like text my friends who are into golf and they're all like, yeah, you should watch it. Yeah, it's like the where I'm spending a lot of time, it's just like golf country. People just fucking golf here. And since I'm here, I'm like, okay, I might as well try this golf thing out. I really never... Like, my temperament is really not... I mean, I'm laid back and stuff, but, like, the kind of, like, frustration of, like, even mini golf, like, stresses me out. So, if we're gonna... I don't know if I'm gonna keep pursuing it. I even feel weird. I think it's important to go on the record about this. I feel a little weird about it. It's, like, the most, like, uncomfortable I've been in the, like, hour and a half we've been talking. Or I guess we're not,
oh, no!
No, it's fine. You know, because we did a little catch-up beforehand.
The reason I mentioned, though, the Tiger documentary is, you know, kind of the opposite. Like, I don't know anything about golf, and I know so little about it that I didn't know, oh, everyone knows Tiger Woods was a child prodigy or something. I mean, I just heard of Tiger Woods when he was a superstar athlete in the late 90s, you know?
Yeah.
But I didn't know his whole childhood story, and it's fascinating, and the relationship with his father, but also... Just like in terms of excellent documentary filmmaking, it made me really interested in golf. It made me like it's a sports documentary, so it's edited so that there are suspenseful golf moments. And it really it made me think like, oh, wow, I can't believe I just had this many emotional reactions to golf scenes or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So I say go further. Go to, listen, Chris, if you're going to do golf, do it like you do burnt.
Right. Yeah, 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 exactly. Well, one of my friends that I talk to about burnt every day, he was like super, super supportive. He golfs and he loves it. But it does seem like, I think there is kind of like a musician's underground of musician golfers. Oh, like my friend Gordon, I guess I won't say where he lives, but he goes golfing every day on this golf course in Los Angeles nearby where he lives. And he often plays with Kurt Cobain's childhood hero, King Buzzo. So,
oh, wow.
You know, with a big shock of white hair, he's like a very big golfer. And I think that there's more of us out there, more potential. Me being one of us, potentially. I've had two lessons so far.
Yeah, no, I get it. I think people associate golf with something like elitist, but
yes.
Also in this time when everyone's getting more comfortable with being out in the middle of nowhere, the idea of just being kind of alone with your stick and a ball in a giant green field, you know, where you're just like, I just like hitting the tiny ball with the long stick alone in the
yes.
middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
That's also, exactly. That's still called golf. Also, do you know Cam Avery, who plays with Tame Impala?
You know, I've never met him, but yeah, I know of
him,
totally.
He could tell you where all of the underground golf is happening.
Oh, you got an in for the indie rock golf mafia. Okay,
the IGM, the indie golf mafia.
Yeah, the IGM.
Well, that seems like a perfect place for us to conclude, Chris.
All right,
thank you so much,
Jenny. Thank you so much for having me. This is an absolute pleasure.
Love that guy. Thanks again to Chris Bayo, and thank you again for listening. That brings us to the end of episode 57 of LSQ. Episode 58, out in a few weeks, features individual interviews with each of the members of the Houston trio Krungbin. Excited to share that one. And if you haven't already subscribed, consider doing that. And you can reach me with feedback on Twitter @JennyLSQ. I'll talk to you next time.